Welcome to Losing a Child, Always Andy's Mom. On this podcast, we journey through the devastating experience of the death of a child. Grief is seldom discussed openly in our culture, and the death of a child makes people feel even more uncomfortable. We approach the topic openly and honestly, speaking to people who have lost loved ones and experts who help care for them. Whether you are a parent experiencing loss or someone who wants to support another going through this tragedy, this podcast strives to offer hope and help.
Welcome to episode 234 of Losing a Child, Always Andy's Mom. I'm Marcy Larson, Andy's mom. Today, I have the pleasure to speak with Susan, Chad's mom. Now, we go a little long, so I won't do a real introduction, but know that you will absolutely love her because I certainly did. I do want to take a little minute, though, to talk about the upcoming live stream. So there will be a live stream on Monday, March 18th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And this live stream is going to be on the topic of feeling out of control. This is actually my husband Eric's idea. So when you are in grief, it often feels like everything in your entire life is spinning out of control. And we want to just delve into that a little bit and how people felt about that. So I've got a couple of questions for you to think about and to email me with some responses. So the first questions are, in what areas of your life specifically did you feel out of control? Either in your early days or even now, even if it's years later. So email me the answers to those questions, again, at marcy@andysmom.com, or look for those questions on social media, on Facebook or Instagram, on the Always Andy's Mom account. So remember to tune in on either Facebook or Instagram live on Monday, March 18th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Right now, though, just sit back and listen to Susan, Chad's mom. So much for agreeing to come on the Always Andy's Mom podcast today.
Hi, I've watched you and listened to you for 3 years now, and you always think like, oh, I want to tell my story, but sometimes to get to this point, boy, you have to muster up a lot of courage and thought. So
I am really looking forward to talking to you today and hearing all about your great son, Chad.
We have three boys. Yeah. He was our youngest, and I'd like to tell the story that like my husband wanted two and I wanted four boys. And so it was like, I kind of slipped that third one right in at the end, and like, what a blessing that he was to both of us.
And I think it's funny that you wanted all boys. Like, you never had any desire for girls.
I wanted that messy chaos. You know, I wanted the balls and socks. And I guess I grew up, I had three brothers and a sister. And it was just like, I don't know. I just had that athletic. Yeah. I wanted that athletic being in our house. You know, it was just a lot of fun. We had good dirty chaos in our house all the time, you know.
Well, and I guess with a house with three boys, we're kind of a boy house then, weren't you?
Yeah. There was a lot of wrestling and a lot of silliness and, you know, climbing on the roof and trampoline, and they just had so much fun. They were just like best friends, and it was a boy house, and boys were always over, and a lot of girls were always over, and it was just a very fun, lively house. And when we're raising kids, and say one goes to spend the night at a friend's house, and so then back to four people in the household, we would always talk about what a strange dynamic this is. It's like it totally shifts the whole house with just one person gone. And how much we now live in that shift of, it has totally changed our lives having it that, you know.
I think that too, on how, you know, just going out to dinner, when you go out to dinner and you're five,
and you can sit at the four top,
wait for a special table.
Right.
You can't, you can't just sit wherever. That, you know, you say to the hostess five and she's got to like look for a spot for you. Yeah. And you sometimes have to wait longer. Yeah. And that was such a painful thing for me after Andy left, to go to a restaurant and to say four.
I agree. That is something so simple in life that you would never think about.
Yes.
It was traumatic.
I hated sitting at a regular table.
Yes.
I mean, a regular booth for four people.
Oh. You can sit in a regular car. You don't realize when you lose someone, it changes every single dynamic of your life. You know, it's just, it's of something so simple of sitting in a four top.
Yeah. Exactly.
You never think, and you're thinking, I'm finally getting out. We're going to go out to dinner. And then like that can totally throw you into a cycle.
Yep. And like, I don't even want to be at dinner now. I don't like the fact that we're sitting at this table that I've never sat at before, you know?
And he was just a lot of fun and silly and kind. And one of the things like going back and thinking about his life, trying to teach your children life skills and things.
Yeah.
And it's like, he's the one that kind of caught on quickly where the other two took a little bit more time, like advocate for yourself, or if someone's not being nice to you in the playground, keep being nice because you don't know what that child is going through at home. You know, like those things. He caught on to those moments really quickly. And those were more ingrained in him. The things that as a parent you want to instill in your children, you know, where sometimes they might take a little longer, or maybe they don't ever develop in certain, you know, people's kids, but he just was always tried to be his kindest. Say you have somebody in your school, like, so we lived in Wisconsin his first 10 years. And that's kind of what we think of as home. And now we live in North Carolina. So he moved in seventh grade. School had already started and my older two were going to be in high school. So I remember driving them to school and he got a little bit of a break moving into seventh grade. And I remember telling them, this is almost like a do-over in a way. Like you're walking in with a clean slate. The effort you put forth when you walk in these schools, you know, can really help you, you know. Well, the other two were kind of, you know, really upset and everything. But Chad, so he walks into a seventh grade class, school had already started, and he walked in with a big smile on his face and said, hey, everybody, my name's Chad. And, you know, like all the kids are kind of laughing and chuckling, but it endured him walking in with that positive attitude and a smile on his face. The one thing, the girls were immediately attracted to him, you know, and took him under their wing and became fast friends with him. He could be really shy. And so whenever the teacher told me that he had done that, it kind of took me by surprise, but it was like, oh, he listened and he reaped the benefits of that. And those friends that he met there were like his lifelong friends. And Chad could be really silly and fun and very athletic. Growing up, he played football and travel baseball and school baseball and loved the game of basketball. That was when he got to high school. That's kind of where he shifted all his efforts to basketball. Loved that. And just like you did not see him without a ball in his hand. Or I was looking at pictures today and his apartment, and it was like when we first set it up and there's like three basketballs laying on his bed, you know, and it was just like that's who he was. He was that kid. He always had a ball with him. He loved being home with his family and his brothers, and he wasn't ashamed that he loved his parents and loved his mom and dad, and showed we had just a really happy household, I guess, too, because when you have brothers, there's always somebody at home to play with, you know, no matter what's going on. It's comfortable to be at home. There's always somebody here to play with. And I was telling the story earlier about how even as they were older, like in college and their home, there's going to be a race around the house to see who can race faster. There's going to be, you have to tie your shoes together and who can make it to spot B. You know, like there was all these games. They weren't like playing video games or anything like that. They were outside or jumping on a slack line or definitely playing basketball to all hours of the night in the driveway. And I'd wake up when he was in high school and I'd hear all these noises and I'd go outside and there'd be like four boys that had drove in and playing basketball at midnight in the driveway, you know? And I'm like, you got school in the morning. Like, does everybody need to go home and go to bed? It was just he was just a very fun kid. Very friendly. He had a lot of shyness to him that I saw a lot of, because I think when he got home, you know, you kind of like your home is your comfort place. So home was kind of where he could kind of decompress and relax, obviously, and stuff. And I was always so surprised when, so at eighth grade, at the end of middle school, his superlatives came out and he got like class clown in his yearbook. And then he got it in his senior year. And I remember talking to one of the teachers and I was like, how did he get class clown? You know? And she was like, oh my gosh, he is just a riot in class. And it's like, he can be very stoic and listen, but he wasn't the kind of class clown that like picked on people or was disturbing to the teachers or anything like that. He was just always happy, always in trying to include people. I'm just so proud of him when I look back and think about who he
about
was
the young man
outside of my house. You know, you always wonder like, oh, what do you do? I know what you do inside. What do you do? And I was just the stories that we heard. There was always a big group of people that they knew that they could come here, come downstairs, have clean fun, do whatever they dance, whatever, because all his little friends were like dancers or cheerleaders. So there was always like commotion and laughter. But they knew that this was a safe place to come and they loved having them come. And because I think also by the third child, like the first one, you're rigid, you follow the rules, you ease up on the second one. So by the third one, you're like, let's have some fun, you know, like that.
Yeah, okay.
Running with scissors is no big deal, you know. So, but when Chad died, one of his friends said something that has stuck with me, and it was like, Chad always showed kindness, even when kindness wasn't warranted. And I look back and I think that really was Chad. When we moved here, he came in and he was super athletic. So he made the basketball team and the baseball team in a seventh grader when, you know, there's not a lot of spots for seventh graders on these middle school teams, whatever. And he took those spots and these boys, there was maybe a boy that didn't really appreciate that and didn't appreciate that the girls kind of really, he got along and could have good friendships with girls and stuff. And so it's not that he wasn't bullying Chad in any way, but you know, young boys, they can be kind of ugly and say things or sarcastic things or make fun behind his back, whatever. And I remember there was a point that I was like, do you want me to call his mom? Like, this is getting out of hand. And he would be like, no, mom, I'm going to keep being nice. That's what you teach your kid in elementary school. No, you got to keep being nice. You don't know what's going on, or, you know, and he's had that ingrained in him. And even if I would get frustrated, he'd be like, no, mom, I'm going to keep being nice. And that little boy turned out to be one of his roommates in college and has been
really
supportive, so upset, knew what Chad was, how kind he was. And so I'm glad, at least for me, that I got to see that transition in this young boy who...
Yeah, for sure.
Because Chad just couldn't understand why he was nice all the time to him, and that it did progress into this boy pursuing him out to like, let's live together in college, let's get an apartment together, you know, that, and that he's been a really big supporter and help for us afterwards. That definitely was who Chad is. And when even one of his friends said, he was kind to others when kindness wasn't always warranted. That was spot on for him. Had a good soul, you know? And sometimes I think maybe that's why God took him, because he had done what he was supposed to do. He was finished with his journey here, you know? I try in a positive way.
I know. It's hard to, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's one of those things that you can say that to yourself, but other people better not say that to you.
Right. Absolutely.
Isn't that funny? How like you can say in your own head.
Right.
But if other people dare say to you, they took your child because he was too good. He's like, whatever.
No. Yeah. That's exactly right. Exactly right. So
why don't we go on now and talk a little bit about Chad's journey and what kind of happened to Chad?
So Chad was a sophomore in college. He graduated high school and then he got accepted to everywhere he applied for, but I'm very thankful he chose to go to Appalachian State. And so that's only like an hour and a half from here, like right up the mountain. And it's a good school. And we wanted him to go to, you know, like we could have kind of pushed him to pursue. And some people would ask him like, do you want to pursue basketball? Cause he really was in a great little basketball player. I mean, he didn't have offers or anything, but he could have definitely gone to like a D2 and walked on and things like that.
Yeah.
But he wanted to you know, stay focused on his studies. He was studying exercise science because his intent was to become a physical therapist. He wanted to stay in that sports realm. So, you know, like he was doing so well in school his freshman year and like Dean's List. And when COVID happened, he was a freshman. And so his freshman spring year, he had to come home and, you know, they sent him home
online, all that stuff.
And we had already committed to an apartment for the next year. You can't live on campus your second year. So we had already signed a lease and everything when fall came back around. And what was happening with COVID was older people, right?
Yeah, right.
Obese people, you know, people with underlying health conditions, people with lung issues, things like that. I mean, and Chad was so
healthy
every day. Yeah. 6'5", 170 pounds, would go run 5 miles every day. He worked out every day. We have a gym downstairs. So it's like worked out every day. When he set up his apartment, it's like he brought as much workout equipment that he could keep in his little room, you know, and just a super healthy kid. So it was, we moved him into his apartment. They were going to do online classes. But, you know, like all his friends were all back up there, you know, after
and
being.
You don't want to make him stay at home, well, right? No. I mean, you don't want to force that.
No,
and that
right.
didn't seem like.
It was such an isolating time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah,
and so like he saw his friends during the, you know, while they were home, like, but we were following all the precautions. They would sit outside. They'd play basketball outside or whatever. I mean, he was fine. We moved him into his apartment and it was probably the second week of school, and Chad and I, we look back and each, the four of us can say that he was our best friend. No, he was my best, you know, like we felt, all four of us felt extremely connected to him. He was not afraid to be a mama's boy. And he and I talked like several times a day when he went back up to school. He called one day and he was just like, you know, I'm not feeling good. I've got a cold. I'm really tired. I feel really congested. And he's like, my face hurts right here. And I was like, oh, you must have a sinus infection. You need to go ahead and come home. We'll get you an appointment because, you know, he was only an hour and a half away. He could, it's online school. He can easily run home real quick, get him into the doctor here rather than trying to find it up there. So he's like, I'm going to wait. I'm going to sleep tonight and I'll see how I feel in the morning. And then, so the next day I'm going to go ahead and come home. So I made an appointment at the doctor and he was like the last patient that day. And I was surprised when he got home, he said, oh, they gave me a COVID test. I didn't even go in. They gave me a COVID test at the car. And so I was kind of like put off by it because I was like, oh, it's probably a sinus infection. And it's going to be how many days before you can get treated for that. But she had told him like, you need to go make sure you isolate, go home and quarantine or whatever. So I had got him already and upstairs. There's a big bedroom and bonus room upstairs and a refrigerator. And I'd loaded him up with things just in case and popsicles and food and drinks, whatever. And told him, you know, you need to go ahead and stay upstairs. Cause we were more afraid as an adult to get it, you know, we hadn't gotten it.
No,
we didn't. We were staying pretty quarantined and stuff. And 2 days later they called and it was positive. But he wasn't feeling any symptoms except being like really tired, eating fine, breathe, you know, he had no lung issues or anything like that. The typical things, right? He did have a headache, but he was still doing his online classes. He spoke to the health department twice, called him, and they told him what day he could go back to school. He was here for, I think, like 10 days, because by then, you know, they do it on the day that you start feeling your symptoms. So that was his 14 days.
Right, and this is, just to remind people, this is long before there were any vaccine or
anything
like that.
Oh, yeah,
this was September. This is when you had to take a test, and it took a long time to get it. Like, you know, now we have a test I can find in 20 minutes or less. But, you know, this is in 2020. So this is before
the beginning of September.
Really,
so six months when it started and everything.
Yeah. So
it definitely wasn't affecting kids that much, you know, and the symptoms that he had were nowhere near the symptoms that other people had.
And then he got better. He seemed really better.
Oh yeah. Yep. He was fine.
He was totally better. He's out of quarantine. Everyone's feeling fine. Go back to school. We're good.
Yeah. So before he left that day, he was still kind of tired. You know, he wanted to get back to school and talk to one of his professors about one of his grades. He didn't want to get off on the wrong foot at the beginning. You know, we're two yeah. weeks into the new school year. We went shopping and loaded up his car with food. And we're sitting on the couch and we're just talking, and he's sitting in the chair with the dog and he's kind of laying there, and he looks at me and he kind of has tears in his eyes. And he said, "You know what, Mom, you and Dad are my best friend." And I was like, "Oh, buddy, you're my best friend too." I was like, you know, I talk to you probably more than I talk to my girlfriends, you know?
Yeah.
And I kind of like, it was such a sweet moment, you know? And I'm so thankful in that moment. I don't know why. I grabbed my camera. I had my phone sitting right there and I took a picture of him. And he's kind of disheveled. You know, he probably hadn't taken a shower that day. His hair was all messed up. He's laying there with the dog. And because that was just like, what an amazing moment for him to say. Yeah. And I remember he kind of jumped up and he said, "I got to go right now." Like, it was almost like, if I don't go right now, I'm not going to go.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was like, so, you know, he left and went back to school. Looking back at his like bank statement, he stopped and got him something to eat. And then the next morning, so that was like a Monday. So the next morning was Tuesday, and he called me that morning and he was typing the letter to his chemistry professor that he wanted to send. And he read it to me. It was early that morning. It was probably like 8 o'clock. And I was like, "Oh, that letter sounds great. Oh yeah. You know," cause it was like trying to set up a meeting, and teachers didn't want to meet face to face with kids at that time, you know, and he really wanted to meet with him and go over some things. That was like 8 o'clock. And then around 10:30 ish, he called me again and he was like, "Hey Mom, did you get into my emails?" And I was like, cause you know, they're assigned their own email through the school, through the university, you know,
I didn't know. Like,
how would I get into that, you know? And I was like, "No." And he was like, "Are you sure that you didn't get into my emails?" And I was like, "Chad," like, I kind of thought he was joking around, you know, it wasn't anything super serious. And I was like, "No, Chad, what are you talking about?" "Well, somebody hacked into my email." And I was like, "Well, what did they do?" You know, I'm thinking they got into his account, money account, you know?
Right.
They were like, "Well, there's a letter to one of my professors." And I was like, "Well, what did it say?" And so he read me this letter that he had just written 2 hours earlier that he had read to me. And I was like, "Chad, that's the letter. Like, we talked about that this morning. That's the letter you sent." And it didn't dawn on me. Like, it was just, I thought he was kind of joking around, you know, he was a silly kid. And he was like, okay. And he's like, because he said, "Mom, it's a really good letter. If you wrote it, I'm not going to be mad at you." You know? And I was like, "I didn't write that. You wrote that." And he was like, "Oh, okay." And so he's like, I think I'm going to go for a run, because he lived downtown up in Boone. And so I was like, okay. And I didn't think anything of it. So he called again later in the like right at the end of, it must've been probably 4 o'clock. He sounded okay, but he could not finish the sentence that he was trying to get out. He was saying that, "I just finished my art class, my online art class. And I just finished my online art class." And he repeated that like 4 or 5 times, and he couldn't get out that he couldn't think of that next part that he wanted to say. I was like, "Chad, what's going on?" And he's like, "Yeah, I don't know." And I'm like, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Did you fall down on your run?" And he was like, "No." I'm like, "Did you hit your head on anything?" And he was like, "No." My older son at that time came in, and I was like, "Will you talk to him to see what's going on?" They talked for a minute and he's like, "Yeah, there's something not quite right." And you know, like the things that run through your mind, like, is there a carbon monoxide issue going on in there? Right. You know? And I'm thinking, do I need to call the fire department? But did he, you know, did somebody slip him something? Did you take anything? Like, did you take any kind of medication? No. And I was like, "I need to get it. I'm coming to get you." And he was like, "Okay." And we hopped in the car. My son came with me so he could drive Chad's car back. And I honestly was thinking that he was having like an anxiety, something, a mental breakdown anxiety thing. Cause he was really worked up over this chemistry issue and stuff. He had a certain grade level that he wanted, and for some reason that was overly bothering him. On the way there, because it's like an hour and a half, we drove up there, and I was like, when we call him to check on him, say, hey, we're in the car, we're coming. Oh, you're coming? Why are you coming? He didn't realize that he couldn't remember that conversation that we had just had 10 minutes ago. And then he was like, I think I'm going to jump in the shower. And because I was telling him, whatever you do, don't leave your apartment. And his, for some reason, lived with three guys. Nobody was there. They were all out. And I was like, whatever, don't leave. Stay right there. We're coming. I didn't want him to wander out. I didn't want him to run into police and have some sort of altercation. And, you know, like, I needed to get to him. So in the meantime, while we're driving there, we got a call from one of his close girlfriends. And she was like, there's something. I got a call from Chad. There's something not right. And I was like, I know, we're on our way. We're going to be there in like 5 minutes. So we get there and we call him because he's in like a secure building. He lived in like this warehouse thing, and he had to come down and let us in. And he was like, I was like, okay, Chad, we're here. You need to come down and let us in. And he was like, surprised that we were there. Oh, why are you here? Did you come to visit? So it's like, we get up to his apartment and he's laughing and he's walking and talking fine and he's cutting up and he's happy to see us. And I said, you know, let's pack a bag. I think, why don't you just come home for tonight? And he was like, yeah, I think that's probably a good idea. Yeah. So he jumps in the car with me. By that time, one of his roommates had come in and he and his girlfriend were there. And I didn't understand what's going on. I certainly didn't want to embarrass Chad in front of his roommates, you know? And I said, Chad's going to come home for the night. And the guy was like, yeah, he's been repeating things a lot.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay. So we get in the car, we drive home, and there was some anxiety issues that were kind of coming up, and he was like focusing on his PowerPoint, like his grades. He was looking at his grades a lot, you know, and I was like, you put that down. And there was an anxiety building up. So I really did think it was more like he was having an anxiety issue about school and the pressure of school. You kept hearing it everywhere where kids were having tons of anxiety and mental issues about the pressures. Right. So really that's where I was thinking that it was. He was fine.
Right.
We're driving home and, you know, there's a moment on the freeway where we're getting into town and there's the drive off for the hospital. And I was thinking, I need to take him to the hospital, but I was scared that they were going to bring him to like the mental part, you know, and that I wouldn't be able to get to him. Right. And I said, Chad, you know, I think maybe we need to go to the emergency room. And he was like, no, mom, I just think I need to just go. Let's just go home. I just want to go home. I went ahead and we drove home and we got home and my husband's here and they're laughing and cutting up. And he was just like, I think I just want to go lay down, go to bed. I don't even think he had anything to eat that night. You know, it was probably like close to 10 o'clock by the time we got home. One of his brother's rooms is right next door to him. And I was thinking, I'm going to sleep in Kate's room while you're, and he was like, no, mom, I'm okay. Like, you can go ahead and go to bed with dad. And I just thought, no, I'm going to lay down here in case you need something during the night. And so it was probably about 6:30 or 7 the next morning. I heard him call out. He was like, mom. And I went to his room and he's like, I'm having trouble. I can't move. I can't roll over. So he was kind of rolling over, but it was like really strenuous for him to roll over. He didn't sit up or anything like that. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to call the doctor first thing when they open. They open like in an hour. And he was like, okay. And so I just laid there and talked to him for a while. And we just chatted. It wasn't anything like super, like he didn't say like, oh, I have a terrible headache or, you know, I can't breathe or anything like that. He was just like trying to explain, like everything felt so heavy and he was just struggling to roll over or lift his arm or whatever. And I called the doctor at 8 o'clock and was kind of talking to him about the symptoms and stuff. And she's like, you know, I talked to the nurse came back and she's like, I talked to the doctor, you need to get to the emergency room. And so she's like, where do you want to go? And I'll call ahead. And this is hard for me, but there's two health systems here and the other hospital that we're not like that our doctors aren't with is like Wake Forest before they joined this other program. And they were really like the better hospital system in here. And I said, well, I'd like to call Wake Forest. And she was like, I can't call there. You know, that's not part of our system. So against my better judgment, I was like, well, where should I go? And so she named the hospital and I was like, okay, well, that's where we'll go. And when we were like, I went into his room, I was like, and we were trying to get him dressed and we had to help him up. And he tried to stand up to get dressed and he fell down and we kind of thought he was choking in a way, you know, because it's not like he was crying or the emergency part of the situation hadn't truly kicked into us yet. We realized he could not stand up or walk or anything. And so like I went and got the ottoman in the living room and Robert picked him up and put him on the ottoman to wheel him closer to the door so we could put him in the car. And I remember his feet, because we had his tennis shoes on and the rubber he couldn't even pick up his feet and they kept getting dragged along. You know what I mean? Red flag of all this stuff. So we get him to the hospital and I knew that we were going to be staying a couple of days. So I had a bag packed. I was packing my bag and packing him a little bag, you know, making sure we had our toothbrushes and everything. And I remember we got out of the car with him and they were waiting there in a wheelchair and Robert had to pick him up and put him in the wheelchair. And I'm like, okay, you go park the car and I'll see you inside. And they turned to me and they're like, what are you doing? You can't come inside. And I was like, well, no, like I need to be here. Like this, I have to come inside with him. Like he's having memory issues. He's not gonna be able to tell you
what's going on. Yeah.
And they were like, well, we'll call you, you know? And I went and I was just like, I remember being kind of like taken aback by that. And I walked out to Robert and I was like, they won't let us come in. And I was like, I don't feel right about this. I need to go get him and move hospitals. And so I went back in and they met me at the door and I was like, I want him. I'm going to take him to the other hospital. And they were like, no, he has to see the doctor first. And I wish I would have put my foot down because there's no rule. Like I'm sure there's no law that says that I can't give me my child back, no matter if he's 18 or 19. He was 19.
Well, you could just ask him, and if he couldn't make the decision himself, like I would.
They're like, if you really want to talk, and I remember they were just.
I mean, obviously, you'd have to sign out AMA and all that stuff against medical advice, but you know,
people. But I mean, like he hadn't even seen the doctor yet. I mean, like he was just. I'm like, he's right there, and they were like, "Well, you're going to have to see the doctor first." And I should have said, "Okay, let me see the doctor," you know, but I didn't. I went back, and we sat down in the parking lot. I don't, you know, I guess it's just standard test that they do at that time, and everything was kind of coming back normal. And I think at that time he did a CT scan, everything came back normal. And the doctor, like one of the things that they had asked for, ordered a MRI, but the MRI tech didn't want to give him an MRI because there were several instances, like she didn't want to clean the machine. She didn't want to, he couldn't walk. He couldn't put himself onto the bed. He couldn't carry himself onto the bed. So all these things were written down in the medical records that we found out later. So probably about 7 o'clock, we're sitting in the parking lot all this time and we are trying to, they are allowing us to talk to him. Like the nurse would call us and let him talk to us. And it was just such a pitiful thing because he wanted his parents and he wanted his mom. He couldn't understand. He didn't have the memory to understand. We're here. They won't let us in. We're here outside. We're waiting for you. You know, we are here. They just won't let us see you. And I think that is so hard.
So hard on him.
Yeah. To think that was my baby and they wouldn't let me get to him. And
eventually they did realize that this wasn't enough care for him.
Right. And they did put him for a transfer. He needed to get to the bigger hospital and stuff. And that takes hours and hours and hours. And so I'm thinking, okay, we're seeing ambulances kind of come and go very infrequently, but I thought like, okay, if we wait here long enough, an ambulance is going to come. And so we were sitting out by the ambulance bay because I thought at least we will see him.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, it's like 10:30. We've been there since like 9, 8:30, 9 o'clock. So we had been there over 12 hours, and Robert was like, let's go home. We need to go get something to eat. And of course, that's when they, of course, the minute that we left is when the ambulance finally came and transferred him. And I think, like, if he would have just seen our faces as they wheeled him outside into an ambulance, I think that could have maybe brought him a little relief and know that we were there. You know, they bring him to the bigger hospital. They order another MRI that for some reason gets canceled by doctors that hadn't even, the neurologist that hadn't even seen him yet. But they get him up into a room, and the nurse was good about, she'd call me every couple of hours to talk to him. And I could just, you know, like, and he'd be like, when are you coming? When are you going to be here? And I think, like, that was so heartbreaking to know that he just comprehensionally couldn't understand why we couldn't be there, you know. And the nurse was like, I keep telling him, like, he can't, like, they're not allowing people here. He just, and I was like, those are signs that something is wrong. And I kept hearing the delay. And at one point we had sent his phone in with him, a change of clothes and his phone, and they sent it back out. And the nurse was like, he can't hold the phone. He's unable to hold anything right now. And so, I mean, like, that was, because I kept thinking, well, at least he could call us anytime. So yes, we lost that part of the communication with him too. So it was probably about 7 o'clock in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning. And I'm talking to the nurse, and I'm like, there is a tremendous decline. I can hear it in his voice. And she's like, I know he needs his mother. Like, I've called around, and I'm trying to get you, see if I can get you in. And so finally around 9 o'clock, she called and she's like, okay, y'all can come now. And so we rushed to the hospital, and my husband's sitting outside, like, it's only one person can go in and stuff. So he's in the car park, and I run in there, and he's in his room alone. And like, the wall, you know, you have to think about, it's COVID. There's nobody that's allowed in the hospitals, and the halls are empty, and there's nobody around. And nurse, you know, like, I even walked in this floor, and it's all quarantined off and everything. And I'm just like busting through. There is nobody. I'm like, where am I going? But luckily I knew his room number. So it's like, I finally made it to his room. And like, when I walked in, and the look on his face of relief, and he was just like, oh, mom, like, you're finally here, you know.
Yeah.
And it was just like hugging him and telling him how much we love him, and that dad was downstairs, and that we had been waiting in the parking lot for him and everything. There was just such a relief in him and stuff. And the nurse comes in and kind of tries to explain what's been going on and stuff. And she had said that the neurology team had already come by early in the morning and assessed him, and felt that he didn't qualify for neurology care. And she's like, and I was just like, what? I don't understand that. And so she let me call him, and we spoke in the hallway, and I was really upset and with him. And he was like, I talked to him. He was fine. We had a great conversation. And what a great kid you have there.
That's the whole problem, because he could fake it.
Yeah, he was like,
and he wasn't worried because he couldn't remember what had been happening.
Right. He could have.
I was thinking about that when you got in the room. I mean, you could be comforted by the fact that he does not remember you not being there.
Either. I hope that.
I'm sure he doesn't. I mean,
the anxiety of it, but
right, like, now, like, he's here, there. He probably thought you'd always been there, like,
yeah,
because he couldn't, like, remember any of that. Yeah.
You could have a fine conversation, but why don't you come back 10 minutes later and see if he remembered you even being in there, you know?
And he wouldn't. That's what I was trying to tell him. Which is why I think he didn't remember you not being there either. Yeah. So I doubt he stayed that upset.
They talked about school. They talked about, you know, basketball, all these things. So I was just so upset when I got off the phone with this. I'm not that confrontational person. And I mean, I was like yelling at this guy, this doctor, like, there has been significantly declined. Like, there's something wrong here. And so whenever I got it back into the room, and the nurse was like, you know, that didn't go too well. I'm like, no. And she's like, I have the power to call the rapid response team from the ICU if I need to. And she's like, and I was like, I think you should. And she's like, I think I should too. And so she did. And they came in, those blessed nurses, and they immediately saw him, and they were like, he needs to be in the ICU immediately. call your husband, get him up here. And so they had a huge team come in. And I remember telling him, Chad, you're going to the ICU and you will not be alone again. They will not leave you. And he was like, the relief on his face, you know, that he wasn't going to be alone anymore, because this other nurse had 10 other patients. He was trying to, Robert, they're coming, you know, they were rushing him down the hall and it's just like this figure of, like, I always think about OJ Simpson, like running through the airport in a way. He's running as fast as he can to get to the elevator. And he just hops in as soon as the doors closed, you know, and we're packed with this huge, you know, the bed and all these nurses and equipment. And he's able to lean over the bed and just pat him on the head and give him a kiss on the head. And he's like, I'm here, buddy. I'm here with you. You know, and it's like, Chad was so relieved that we were there with him. We get to the ICU and they're like, okay, you have to stay in the waiting room. We're going to go get him all set up. And I was like, okay, finally, you know, we're going to figure out what's going on. Right before I'm waiting for that team to come down, I had taken a picture of his vital signs. Yeah. So I have that timestamp. So we're waiting in the waiting room. And then here come there's probably four or five doctors come and, you know, they sit down and they're like, they are talking about how they needed to intubate him and spinal tap. And they felt that it was Guillain-Barré. And I had never heard of it before. And they're telling, you know, the thing, they're going to make him comfortable. As soon as they get him stabilized and everything, we'll be able to go in and see him. But they were giving him a sedative to kind of calm him down. He was really anxious and everything. So they're kind of, the doctors are talking amongst themselves. And I remember I Googled what's Guillain-Barré, and I took a picture of it. And I remember the first words that it said was recoverable. And I just remember that complete relief that I felt at that moment. So, you know, then he comes back and he's talking to us and he's kind of explaining a little bit more about what's going to be happening. And I remember, so I was like, so is this going to be, are we talking like a week, like, is it going to be going home in like a week or a couple of days? And he was like, no, you need to prepare. This could be months, you know? And I was thinking, oh, but you go into mom mode, like, okay, this is how we're going to handle it. And I'm going to come here every day and I'm going to stay here with him in the room. And
well, and to just give a little background about what Guillain-Barré is and how they kind of messed up here, because that's not what he had. So Guillain-Barré syndrome, you do lose motor function. It's a post-viral, usually. It can be after any sort of viral illness, sometimes after a vaccine, sometimes after, I mean, who knows what triggers it. It ends up being an immune response, and it will shut down your motor function, usually kind of starting with the legs and kind of going up. And so, and you can end up losing control of your diaphragm, so you can no longer breathe, which is why they oftentimes have to do an intubation. But it does not affect you cognitively. So your thinking is normal. Right. It's fine. And that is a big mistake they made. And I feel like that, when I had talked to you about this before, I felt the whole time I was thinking like, oh, and if only they would have known just how off he was mentally, they might not have jumped to that. But I think they were so fooled by having these conversations that seemed normal,
right,
that they thought that cognitively he was okay. And they weren't really listening to you talk about us or the nurses. Okay.
Yeah. Because nurses had it written down over and over and over, and they were writing it in red, bold letters. And it was like.
But that was a mistake for sure.
Absolutely.
Because then they went down this Guillain-Barré path.
And they intubated him.
Which was not what.
Put him in a coma, basically. So they told us, like, go home. This is, you know, let us get him ready. They did lumbar. Something happened on the lumbar puncture also. They ended up, because usually that's done bedside, correct? Mm-hmm. Typically.
Yeah.
They tried twice. Something happened. We never got to the bottom of that. They had to take him into surgery to do a lumbar puncture.
Yeah. It can be really difficult when the pressures are really high. I
that should have been a clue too. At that moment, you know.
Yeah.
So they call us. It was much later. I mean, they would call and say, like, he's still kind of agitated. He's fighting the anesthesia. We just need a little bit more time to get him comfortable before you can come back in and say goodnight. So they called probably about, it was 9 o'clock. And they were like, okay, he's resting comfortably. He looks great. Why don't y'all can come and say goodnight. So Robert and I rush over there and still only one person at a time. So Robert walks in and he spends like 20 minutes with him, comes back to the car. We sit for a second. He's like, he looks great. He is intubated. He looks like he's sleeping. He looks great. The nurse says he's doing great. So I'm like, okay, great. So it's my turn to go. And so about the short time I get there and I'm thinking, am I in the wrong area? Because there is a ton of action at his door. There's probably four or five nurses on the outside, four or five people on the inside. I could see through the glass and they're working on him. And I heard someone say, yeah, he's fixed and dilated. They hadn't acknowledged me yet. And I'm standing there.
And so your husband had thought he was better, but in fact, he was way worse.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I called Robert and I was like, what happened while you were here? I said, there's all these people in his room. And I said, Robert, they said his eyes are fixed and dilated. And he was like, what? And so I like kind of walked closer to somebody. I was like, what's going on? Like, I'm his mom. And they kind of all move away from me because at the time they were handing things through the door, right? Because it's COVID and some people were in outfits and they were handing medication through the door, but they removed themselves from me. And I was in a position where I didn't want to be told to leave, right? It would have been really easy to say, oh, you can't be here anymore, leave. So I was really trying not to say anything.
Yeah.
I should have busted in there and said, please tell me. Finally, one of the nurses came and said, is your husband still downstairs? And I said, yes. And she said, you need to have him come up quickly. So when he came in, they brought us back out to the waiting room and they said, a doctor will be with you in a moment. So I never even got to go in there and see him. And I just, you know, that shaking feeling that you have that starts inside where you just, it's like the shaking. Of shock almost. And, you know, and I look at this moment and we are in this huge hospital and it's completely deserted and there's nobody there in this huge waiting room in the ICU. We're there completely alone. There aren't even people walking the halls. Finally, a doctor comes and says, he's got brain swelling. There's something going on. We need to get permission to go in and put a tube in, relieve the pressure. And we were like, oh my God, what is happening? They go off. It's the middle of the night and we are there completely alone. And it's like, they call probably about 45 minutes later, the phone rings at this random phone across the waiting room, you know, and it was them. And they said, you know, everything went fine. The doctor will be there to talk to you in a minute. We're like, okay. And so they walk out and you see things happen on TV, right? Like ER dramas and stuff. And you see the two doctors in their surgical suits and you see that gloom and doom on their face, you know, on TV. And you see that it's happening in real life to you, you know, and it's very hard to wrap your head around it. And so they come out and they say that we've had some problems. There's still swelling going on. Like, how far do you want us to go to save him, you know? And we were like, what are you talking about? You know, like we are.
Exactly.
How did this
happen? You don't know. You didn't have any idea that they.
What kind of life
saving you didn't know.
Do you want for your 19-year-old son? We want him no matter what, like no matter what stage he's in. I remember Robert saying, I don't care what kind of stage he's in. We want our son, you know?
Yeah.
And so they were like, okay, we're going to have to go in, like remove his skull cap or whatever to see if we can get some of the pressure to go down. Rob, my husband and I, we've been married for 30 years. And, you know, we used to sit back and kind of like laugh about our life that like, we're kind of sliding under the radar with our life because it was like, we had a happy marriage and we had three great kids and we loved each other and our kids, we love our kids. Our kids love us. And it was like, we're doing pretty good, you know, like, could we win the lottery? How great that would be. But, you know, like, we're scooting by, you know, under the radar, nothing good, nothing bad happens, you know. And I remember
this happened. Yeah.
We're in this big waiting room by ourselves in shock. And I remember that we pulled these two chairs together facing one another where like our knees kind of intertwined and we just hugged each other and we stayed there for. We couldn't even speak.
And I look back and I think, like, that moment together with my husband, with nobody around in the middle of the night, was such, like, this most incredibly bonding moment that we had between right. the two of us, you know, that no one else would ever have. And it would, like, no matter how close we were before that, it brought us to such a, in this horrible tragedy and the most horrific thing that we were going into in our lives, we shared something between the two of us that there wasn't anybody around. There were no distractions. There were no family. There was nobody, people asking questions. There was no phone calls. It was just the two of us holding each other tight and experiencing the most horrible thing. But it was like the most important moment in our lives almost together.
Yeah. Yep. I get that. You know, we were, Peter was hospitalized after the accident, you know, because of the concussion and things. And I remember it was like 2 a.m. We went off to a waiting room because we were both crying so hard and we didn't want to wake up Peter and our daughter, Katie. We didn't want to wake them up. And so we went out in the waiting room and I remember sitting there with him and us saying to each other, this will not break us, you know? And it's a moment that I will remember forever. Just the two of us, like, promising each other that we will be there for each other in this most horrible moment. So that seems very comparable. Like, you didn't even speak, but you had the moment of, like, you are my strength and I am yours.
Yeah. And it's like, there's no other people that lived that moment, that it was just the two of us. And we talked about that for a long time afterwards, that no one can understand what that what that moment was like for us. And it's like, I'm out of all the horrible tragedy, I am thankful to that we were alone and together in that moment without any other distraction, you know, because it just beautiful. However downhill it was going, it went downhill really quickly.
And it did. Obviously, they kept trying to do they did the surgical things, but the pressure just kept going. Yeah. And there was no getting him back.
And I realize that now, like, they were like, okay, we're going to wait 48 hours and see where he's at. But I know that, looking back, I know that they were giving us time to come to terms with.
They were giving you time, but they were also trying to wrap their heads around what had happened to themselves. Right. Probably. I mean, it's hard. It's hard on teams too, when they lose young kids absolutely. Like this. And I'm sure they felt like, man, I wish we would have caught this. But it turns out, you know, an autopsy ended up being done. Right. And he ended up with a very, very rare complication that is a post-viral thing, just like the Guillain-Barré, but it attacks the brain in a much more severe way. Yeah. Weston-Hurst syndrome. And I mean, it's extremely, horrible, and it's extremely rare, and it's also extremely fatal. I mean, there are people that survive it, but, you know, when you get it like he got it and it comes on so rapidly, it's a horrible thing. It's a horrible thing, but it's not something that people jump to think, oh, this is what's going on.
Yeah. And you know, like, after the surgery, and they let us basically move in to his room, and, you know, we had complete access to him, and his brothers were able to stay with him and everything. And I remember just laying there, like, there was some really tight moments sitting in his room late at night, and, like, the nurse is really doing a lot of work just to try and keep everything else going. And like, there was a night where they were like, they allowed me to stay in the room, but I couldn't touch him and I couldn't talk to him because it would affect the pressure. I think now, like, was he hearing me? You know, but anyway, kind of stimulation, you know, but, your kids would probably recognize this song. There was this very popular song at the time, and I always hated that song. It was probably like a year or two before, and it was this song by this band. They were called Vampire Weekend, and they're just like, they were really popular at the time. And it was so strange, because in the back of my mind, I hated this song, but there's a lyric that says, I don't want to live like this, but I don't want to die. That was playing in the back of my mind, but I wasn't aware of it, I wasn't paying attention to it. And I think that he was sending me this message, right? Yeah. That he didn't want to live like this, but he didn't want to die. And it was like, it was just such a prominent song, but I wasn't paying attention to it. And it was over and over and over and over and over in my mind. And it's like, it took me forever to get that lyric of that song out of my mind. And I do think that he was trying to send me this message. Yeah. So they wanted us to wait like 48 hours and they said, we're going to bring him back in. It's going to be really difficult to move him. They didn't want to jostle him or anything, but they were going to try and get him back in and do a scan just to check and see where he was. You know, they were warning us that it wasn't going to be good. And Robert and I had three sons. So the theme song for my kids, ringtone on my phone, is my three sons theme song. Do you remember My Three Sons?
Okay.
I always love that show. But for Chad, I had a special ringtone that was some other little ringtone, because we talked so much during the day. That way I knew if I heard his, I knew it was him, and I'd make sure I picked up. And I'll never forget this. It's like it's all these hospital personnel are, you know, disconnecting him from and getting him ready to move him to the scan room. And there's doctors are just so downcast, you know, and they're so solemnly walking behind him. And, you know, it's like 20 people wheeling him down this empty corridor to get the scan. And I remember seeing, like, I knew that these doctors knew what they were going to see, but it was like, we were standing outside the door of his room. And it was like, it was the strangest thing. It was like, I heard the ringtone of his phone, of what I would hear when he'd call me. And I remember I was like, Robert, that is Chad's, that's the ringtone for Chad's phone, you know, when he calls me, you know. And I was just like, and do you know that I have never, ever heard that ringtone again, no matter what?
Really?
And I thought, it was such a weird thing, and it's probably nothing anybody else would pay attention to, but I guess maybe you're looking for a sign, you know? And it was just like,
it was like a little sign from him, wasn't it?
Maybe so, yeah.
Yeah.
So, of course, they came back, and they were like, there's no hope for him, you know? Yeah. He's gone. We'll give you some time, you know? And I at that point, I asked us, like, give me at least 48 hours with him. And so that's when they really let us have his friends come in. And so, like, his best friend came and his little girlfriend came and one of his teachers came from high school, came in and stuff, because they were hearing and they were really like spreading out the word of what was happening to him and stuff. And I think you have to pull yourself together, because here are these 18 and 19 year old kids coming in and you need to warn them about what they're going to see. He's just a mess. And trying to prepare them and their mothers that are coming to support their kid, their best, you know, their son, to come in and say goodbye to their best friend, you know. One of the very sad things was Chad and his best friend, John. They were best friends since John had moved there in ninth grade too. And they met on the basketball team, and they went to different colleges, and Chad really wanted to go to school with John. But John wanted to go to Wilmington. He wanted to go to the beach, and Chad went up to the mountains. And I was like, are you sure you don't want to go, you know, to Wilmington? And Wilmington is at the beach, and Chad was a redhead, freckles. And he was so concerned that, Mom, everybody goes to the beach every day. I'm going to burn. Like, yeah. I know that I shouldn't go to school there. And so John's mom and I had made we're not going to let them go their freshman year in their cars, because, you know, they need to acclimate themselves to campus or whatever and stuff. So they didn't see each other their freshman year, but they saw each other a couple of times. Obviously on break when they were both home for, you know, before school started back up. But John was surprising Chad, and he wasn't telling him. And he drove up to Chad's apartment and knocked on the door, and he called him and he said, where are you? Guess where I am. And he scanned, and Chad saw that he had driven, because that would have been 5 hours. He went to go surprised Chad at his college, and that was the first weekend of his quarantine. And so he never got to see his friend again. And he was just so disappointed that John had driven all that way to surprise him. And he was sick and he couldn't see him. So we had like 48 hours, like I said, his friends came. It was the time to remove him from life support and everything. You know, they like want you to leave the room and they warn you, like they may gasp for air afterwards and stuff like that. But I was like, no, I am going to be here, you know? And there's that moment in Steel Magnolias when Sally Fields is at the funeral and she talks about it's the most significant moment of her life.
Yeah.
And she had to be there when they, and that's exactly how I felt. You know, like
maybe, you were there for his first breath. You would be there for his last.
Yeah. And it was like, as a man, I think like men can't always handle hospital situations and stuff like that. And my husband had a bad hospital situation when he was younger and he didn't really like hospitals. And especially for this, he, like my boys had to get out of there as quick as it happened. Like I know realistically they probably didn't want to be there. And I was like, no, you need to be here. You will regret not being here for this, you know, but they, when it happened and they removed him, they got out right afterwards and they couldn't be there. But for me, it was like how she explained it in the movie. It was like the most significant moment of my life to be there for his last moment, even though he never took a breath. He was probably gone way before that, you know, but it was like, I couldn't, as a mother, you have to be there no matter how hard it is, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I do want to touch on some things that have happened since then, because people have remembered him.
Yes.
People have remembered him in pretty cool ways.
Yeah, they have. One of the first things that we did, our neighborhood, which at the time I was not ready to do this, but, you know, they went ahead and like filed all the paperwork to get a scholarship ready for him to, you know, do all the tax stuff. And they like came knocking on the door presenting us like, we did all the paperwork to do a scholar memorial scholarship. And I was like,
okay.
Thank you. I'm not ready to do that. But we do that for him in his honor. We have committed to, because his varsity number was 10 and his travel ball number since he was 4 years old, he's played travel ball since he was four, was 24. So we committed to 10 years of $2,400 and we do it to two local students and we give them a scholarship. To like, my thing is to help them walk across the stage that, you know, do what he wasn't able to complete, you know. So we do that. They retired, semi-retired, like his basketball number. And that was an amazing night because, you know, like when he died, it was such an isolating time and nobody could be around. We had a funeral for him and we could only have, like, I think we had maybe, we invited like 20 people and I think like 40 snuck it, you know, like 40 people showed up, even though we were trying to make it, we didn't want a super spreader. Like we were so afraid of having this spread and family were afraid to come in. Right. So it's like, we have elderly parents, you know, my siblings were afraid to come and we didn't want a lot of people. We didn't want a lot of people in our house. It's like, now I realize I should have waited, but at the time, you know, you didn't.
Well, yeah.
I'd never had it happen before. I was just thinking, okay, we got to plan a funeral, whatever. But since then, I mean, our high school has just done some amazing things. It was like the following year, it was like when school, they got back into class, they raised awareness of it and what was his favorite color. So during Spirit Week, the following year, it was like everybody had to wear red because, you know, we're from Wisconsin, we got to go red. They retired his jerseys over this past holiday. And that was so amazing because his coach had called and said that they wanted to give us his jerseys and present them to us. And I was like, oh, Robert wanted his jersey more than anything. And we were just so thankful that they were going to give it to us and stuff. And they had called when it was during the basketball, it was like their Christmas tournament. And so that, you know, there were a lot of people there. And a lot of his classmates and all his team were there and a lot of parents were there. His travel ball team was there. And that was just, so nice because all the other things, we had been so alone through it.
Yeah.
You know, like people couldn't come. We were honored with this and this, but it was just like no one could ever be there and stuff. Yeah. So that was like our very first thing that happened where we could actually have people there. And it was just so
and that's so comforting to have, to get that. And that's,
well, you want them to be remembered, right?
Yes.
These kids are in, you know, they're traveling all over the world and going to different schools and they're graduating and starting colleges or you know, starting their jobs. And it's like, I find it extremely difficult. I want that for them. I want them to be happy, but it is difficult to see it. I know for personally, maybe it's because of the time frame and in the time that everything happened, an isolating time that I've maybe find comfort in the isolation of it. And it's hard for me to.
Well, and you were in a really unique experience too, because, you know, you were very isolated.
Yes.
But it was very public, right?
Very
because
public.
I mean, you said the New York Times contacted you to do an article on it because here's this young athlete dying from a complication after COVID. And so
we were,
it was
like, Good
national
Morning America.
Headlines.
Yes.
Right. It was nationally known with his picture and all this stuff. So you're like exposed to everyone, but yet really alone.
Yes.
Not being able to get personal support from anyone. So
right. And with
horrible.
A subject matter that was very volatile.
Yes.
You know, when it happened, we really wanted a message of college students who are not living on, because campuses were trying to do what they could, making sure they were wearing their mask, whatever. Where if you lived off campus, that wasn't happening. And we just wanted a message of, if you think you have it, are you, please isolate.
Yeah, just be careful.
You know, and it was like, we were hitting a lot of resistance with that. And it was just such a volatile, it's still a volatile topic.
Still is. You're right. I mean, when you wrote to me originally, you said, I don't know if you even want to have me on, because you were nervous that I wouldn't want to even talk about it because it had to do with COVID.
Right.
I mean,
you can't say the word in some, like, you know, or they won't monetize your channel or things like that, you know, and it's, and as a person who's, we lost our child, I even had friends that would come up and say like, well, I don't believe in this and I don't want to wear a mask or, you know, like and it was like, I don't need to, like, I don't ever want to get into your choice of if you want to vaccinate or not, but please don't come and like, I don't want to have the conversation with you at minimum. Like, why do you, like, that doesn't help me at all. And it's everywhere.
And you know, millions of kids can get COVID and recover, but yours didn't.
And they all do, right?
Right. And you, but yours didn't. So that's the thing. And that's, I'm in a different, we're in a different place when we lose our children like this, right? What you look at as normal is not normal for other people, but it is for you. Like in your experience, you had one child get COVID in 2020 and he died.
Right. He was like in the 200s, like number 200,000. That's how it was. So I don't, what are they? And you think like,
well, and I told you, I looked up with the Weston-Hurst syndrome and the numbers that I saw that died of Weston-Hurst syndrome post COVID was like three people. So he's one of three that this happened to at least in the first couple of years. And with the data that I looked at, I don't know in sense, but you know, this is not a common thing for sure. But in your case, he was one of the three.
And, you know, like Chad was such a humble kid and he didn't like attention on himself really. And we look back and, you know, like they approached us, he was in People magazine they did an article on 50 people who had died and they did one from each state. And it was like, they were doing an article on Dr. Fauci or whatever. And so it was like the 50 faces of COVID. So he was represented North Carolina and we were like, what a moment. Any kid would want to be in national exposure for things or be in People magazine. But it was like for this, you know, what it's like, it's not
for
fun.
This. And then you didn't really get support you needed either.
Oh, absolutely not. A lot of it is I shut myself off to the world. Like
sure.
I was
sure
just trying to survive and take a step, a breath. And a lot of my focus was I needed to figure out what happened. Yeah. Like what was it that happened? And so thank goodness, like they did want to do an autopsy and it was done at Harvard. So I do feel confident in the results of it, but it was an isolating time. I didn't want anybody around. I personally have kind of maybe taken that too far in my grief recovery. You know, I did go to, I went to a fabulous Christian counselor, grief counselor, who I credit her for, I don't know how to word this without triggering. I don't mean this to be triggering, but it's like, I did not want to live. It's not like I was going to take my life, but it was like living and killing yourself are two different things. I still struggle with that. Everything in our life now has changed, right? Like we talked about how I don't want to take a Christmas picture anymore, like send out Christmas cards. It's not the same. Our vacations aren't the same. You know, you're sitting at a four top table now instead of, you think about how it affects your kids. Even they're in their mid 20s now. And it's like the struggles that they still go through. My middle son had dated a young girl from college during college. And they were reaching the end of their relationship. And one of the struggles he had was no one that I will date, my wife, nothing. They will not have known Chad and know what he meant in my life. That really struck me because you can't explain how important he was to us. They can come to our house and see the shrine that we have created in our house for him, but they will never know what he meant to all of us. That's a difficult thing to know, that you have to face that the rest of your life, whether you learn it, handle it better as time goes on. We talk, you know, people talk about the wave, and I've now realized he died in September. His birthday is in December. So like we're going through those holidays. So we have finally learned fall through New Year's, all four of us are out of commission. It's just too hard for us to manage. Basically, like you're just one step in front of the other. And when the new year hits, we all kind of like, okay, we made it through another year. It's just such a difficult, difficult journey that after that first year, everyone else has gone on with their life and we're still there. I will say that he had a set of friends, and I know that it's hard for them to come. Whenever they come to town, they always stop by. They always come over. They always want to go sit in his room. They'll always post, just sharing their life, coming to check on us. So I always joke about, he had a harem of girls and they would be send me a note like, oh, I had Chad came to me in a dream last night and we were doing this and he was so happy and laughing, couldn't understand why we were crying for him. And it's like, I don't see him very often in dreams, but he goes to those girls all, like those girls dream about him all the time. And I'm just like, of course.
Who comes to your mama once in a while, though, honey?
The cute girls that he grew up with, you know, we miss him. We miss him a lot.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you found this helpful and would like to support the podcast, please leave a 5-star rating and comment. To help financially, you can type Andy's Mom, one word, to the number 53555. This provides a link to GiveButter, which allows donations through PayPal, Venmo, Apple Pay, or credit cards. GiveButter will provide a receipt of your tax-deductible donation. Or you can visit the donation page at andysmom.com/donate. Always Andy's Mom is a registered 501c3 and can receive donations through Thrivent Financial and Benevity. Marcy loves hearing from listeners. Please feel free to reach out to her via email at marcy@andysmom.com or on the Instagram or Facebook Always Andy's Mom accounts. Sign up for the email list to get weekly episode links as well as pictures of Marcy's guests and their children. Together, let's work to inspire hope one day at a time. Thank you.